At what age do children move beyond the influence of their parents? Many believe that once a kid hits their high school and college years, parents are replaced by their child's peers and the media. But research, biblical teaching, and anecdotal evidence tell a different story. Stay with us as we talk to author Dan Dupuy about his new book, It's Not Too Late, and the essential role parents play in shaping the faith of their teens and young adults on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, once again, we welcome you all to this episode of Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Mueller here at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding and joined by Jason Sochnick out on the West Coast. Sunny. Is it sunny in Spokane today?
Oh, it's sunny and it's a great day.
Do you?
Skies are blue.
Yeah. Do you get the, you know, the stereotypical Northwest Seattle type rainy weather? Do you have that or are you...
We have four complete seasons, and so, but a lot of people think Spokane is really close to Seattle, and we're 4.5, almost 5 hours away.
Yeah. And, I didn't think that. I know the geography.
Four seasons.
Okay, good. But you're not getting that torrential, horrendous, depressing, constant. You see my stereotype there. I said there's a stereotype.
Yeah, that's a huge stereotype. Yeah, in fact, Seattle's a great
drink
place
Starbucks
to be
all
in
day.
The summer.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. Well, good. Yeah. Well, Jason, hey, we're going to have a great podcast today. We've got a great guest coming
up. Happy podcast.
Yes, happy podcast. A friend of mine, Dan Dupuy, has written a great new book called It's Not Too Late, The Essential Part You Play in Shaping Your Teen's Faith. Dan and I have a long history of doing ministry together, working way, way back in the day for a campus ministry group called the Coalition for Christian Outreach. So Dan's going to talk about that book that is actually a book written for parents that came out of his work with college students. So it's kind of an unusual connect, but a good connect, I think, that and one worth talking about. So I can't wait to be able to talk with Dan. But before we get into that, we always get into other things. And Chris Wagner and Kenton Hawk are the ones who guide us into those other things with questions and quizzes and
We have two questions for you today because we're going to skip the youth culture news section.
We're not going to talk. Yeah, there hasn't been much happening, right?
Yeah.
That's an impossibility. We just didn't do our homework. We've both been on vacation, so we want to jump into some other things we think would be good.
All right. So I'll start off with
you have a question.
Yep, a lighthearted question, and then we can transition into to maybe a more meaningful question. But so I'm thinking about childhood and athletics and accomplishments and stuff like that. Is there anything, is there perhaps an accomplishment, an athletic or sport-related accomplishment that you are most proud of as a child or as a teenager?
Mm. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
An athletic
I don't know about you, Jason, but, man, there's so many to choose from. You're talking about like awards and accomplishments, first place ribbons. Yeah, where do I begin? That is... How do you choose just one?
Man,
Have you got one, Jason?
I have one?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about the time that I won, and I have to say this humbly, but the time I won the National Under 16 Doubles Tennis Tournament, men's doubles, with my partner CJ Raisin.
Oh, sure.
It was.
Yeah, so for anyone that has not listened to this podcast until now, you will have to listen to earlier podcasts to understand who CJ Raisin is, because they are not a real person. So
no, he is not.
He is not. Sorry.
Was he?
Yeah.
We had a question about imaginary friends several podcasts ago, and that was we all had them.
That was one of them.
But we didn't all have names for them like one of us did.
Didn't.
So yeah, his name has to come up. every now and then.
I guess so.
Yeah, that was
no. Walt, do you have one?
I do.
Yeah. Okay. What would it be?
You know what? And this is a you got to understand the context for this, because this is a huge accomplishment that went horribly unnoticed. Okay. Well, except for the people who were there. So I often say I was on the absolute worst church basketball team in the history of the universe. I was on a team for St. Mark's Church. We had uniforms, okay? Now, this is when I was in 7th and 8th grade. So as a group of boys, we were all 7th and 8th graders. None of us went – well, one guy did go on to play basketball. Oh, no, his son and his daughter went on to play, one at Notre Dame and one at Duke. So there were some good genes there. They were a tall family. But we were all 7th and 8th graders. We were in a league. We had uniforms. Now, you got to understand this. They were black jerseys and black pants with orange lettering.
Nice.
So, I mean, we looked good when we went out, right? Halloween.
That's what counts.
Yeah, we were, and when you think Halloween, people go out and they dress up as what they're not. So we would go out and dress up as we were not, basketball players. And yeah. We played at the Huntington Junior High School gym. But what you got to understand is there were like 7 other teams, and they were all made up of high school guys. So we were middle schoolers playing in a boys basketball league with all high school guys. And so I'll just make this really simple.
Oh, my gosh.
Nobody ever scored. No team ever scored less than 100 points on us. Everybody made it to triple figures. Nobody. We never scored. Our best showing in a game, guess how many points was our best showing? See if you can guess.
4.
What do you think? Yeah, you're low. Kenton, what
42.
Do you think? 42. No. That's way too high.
I was going to guess in the 30s.
No, way too high. 12. The most points we ever scored was 12. So imagine this. Every game was 100-something to 12 or less. And we only scored 12 once. And I was a starter. I was a forward, and I don't know how many games we played, so I can't tell you how many points I averaged per game, but let's let's just say it this way. I scored 2 points all year. Never made a foul shot, but here's the great thing about it. I remember those 2 points like it was yesterday. I set up in the corner and just shot the ball, and it was a swish from the corner with no, you know, obviously no backboard.
That'd be a three-point.
It would have been a three-pointer today. But I can still smell it, hear it, feel it, taste it. But here's the best part of it, that it was church league basketball, so most of the folks in the stands, and we drew more people than anybody else because people wanted to come and see this. The high school boys playing the middle school boys. It was hilarious. I mean, when you think back on it, and – every time we would score, which was rare, the place would erupt. It didn't matter whose side people were sitting on, everybody would stand and cheer. So it was like this major monumental news story whenever we'd score.
Now, two
worst
things
ever.
On that.
Yeah.
One, that is awesome.
You're in middle school, so half your fans were probably your parents that drove you, maybe.
Right, but I'm saying the other kids, the other team's parents would cheer too.
Okay.
They would... Yeah.
And two, I'm starting to realize how many baskets they scored when you made 2 points from the outer corner.
All year.
And so you're going by ones and twos, and they still got triple digits.
Oh, yeah.
That's rough.
Oh, yeah. It was – well, just think about it. It was not just my greatest athletic accomplishment. That's what you asked, right, Chris?
That's right.
It was the greatest character builder of my life. So, and we had fun while doing it. I mean, it was great. It was awesome.
Very
that
cool.
is awesome.
Yeah, can you top that, great. Jason?
I don't know if I can top that. The story that there's two that came to mind, but the one that I'll share is my sport throughout high school was soccer. Soccer was the thing that I loved. To this day, I still think it's one of the best sports out there. And I know that's what everyone's reaction is. But it is such a physically demanding sport. It's a wonderful sport. And so we could have a whole podcast dedicated to the conversations around soccer. Not doing it here. But
nope.
Here's what I would say. because I spent so much time focusing on soccer.
Can I just ask, I'm stuck on the physically demanding part.
Yeah.
Would you say it's more physically demanding than, let's say, washers or bean bags or darts?
Shuffleboard.
Shuffleboard, yeah.
Hey, well, let me just
I'm just
put
trying
one
to get
perspective.
Perspective here.
No,
yeah,
no,
I'm trying
yeah
to
I'll
get
give
perspective.
You perspective.
Say, yeah.
No, let's think about this. There is maybe only one or two other sports around the world where the players run more.
Basketball
I mean,
game.
Think about how
basketball
often
players,
players
run.
Are running.
Basketball players run and, more in a game, in a 48-minute game, than soccer players
oh,
run
boy,
in a 90-minute game.
Oh man, look at
this
the data
podcast
guy.
Is going
I
to be
actually,
over.
Would,
he is
I
fired
would,
up. You should see the expression
I would totally
on his face.
Disagree with this. I would totally disagree with this, and
you
we
know,
can
the,
we can
the,
look
the,
at this for future podcasts.
All right,
we'll look at this data. Yeah, yeah, we'll take a look at this.
We're going to come back and talk about sports because this is yeah.
So obviously. Maybe I need to stick with my soccer story because you guys are so worked up.
Well, I asked for an athletic accomplishment, so that wouldn't count anyways.
Oh, by the way, this is what happens with all conversations around soccer. Everyone gets worked up, and those that are fans like myself get so frustrated, and then everyone that doesn't like it, they make incredibly I don't want to say stupid excuses, but they are not very strong arguments. Yeah, because I have convinced more than one person to become a soccer fan. So we will leave it at that. I'm not going to.
Now, wait a second.
I now have decided I'm not using the soccer fan.
What kind of accomplishment is that?
I haven't gotten to my accomplishment.
No, I'm talking about making someone a fan.
Oh, that's a wonderful accomplishment.
Because it's so difficult.
I could say the same about hockey.
Yeah, I'm sure you can. I'm messing with you here. Go ahead. I'm sort of messing, but
okay.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, you're sort of.
Well, I'm just
okay,
working
so anyways,
through
because,
your reasoning.
Because I focus so much on soccer, I didn't focus a lot on other sports. But I did have a period where I played quite a bit of baseball, or what I thought was a lot, not compared to the other ball players that I was on eventually on a team with. But my favorite memory was I was a sophomore in high school, and I tried out for the team because in Arizona, where I grew up, you played soccer during the winter, during the winter. Most times it's usually in the fall throughout most of the country, but because of Arizona, the weather allowed us to play in the winter.
Was that an option to detention?
That was.
Okay, right. Keep going.
Yeah, so I tried out for baseball. I thought, I'm going to do baseball, and I tried out. And I don't know what it was, but I had a fear of catching the baseball. I could field the baseball if it was on the ground, hit me in the chest, whatever, totally fine. But I was one of the only baseball players probably to have ever played the game that had a fear of catching a pop fly. Like, I had an absolute fear of getting bonked in the nose. I don't know what it was. It just wasn't the way. And so I constantly was not a great outfielder. And that was really the one place that I probably was most able to play if I were going to be on the field. Anyways, fielding, I got, you know, a failing grade. But hitting, I was an excellent hitter. I was a great hitter. I was a really good hitter. And so this is what happened. I made the high school baseball team, but it had – so you know how you go to the locker room and you see if your name is on there, if you've made the final cut? Mine had an asterisk, and I needed to go – to the coach to ask him, okay, what? There's an asterisk here. What is it? And I went to him, and this is exactly what he said. Jason, you are a great hitter. You can hit the ball with the best of our teammates. You will never, never get on the field. you stink as a fielder. You're only going to make the team to be a pinch hitter. That's all you get to do. If you come on our team,
you need to move to England, yes, where you can play both soccer and cricket.
That's right. Hey, you still have to field. So
that's your memory. How did you?
Well,
I thought we were starting with a soccer memory. What we morphed into this?
No, I didn't. I said I played soccer.
Oh,
so
okay.
I was setting it up to say I did not play much baseball, and that's what ultimately ended up happening.
Yeah.
So that's.
Yeah.
So I got on the team, was not a great fielder, wasn't my sport that I focused on.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
That's
good. I don't know if I could, yeah.
We learned something about each other here.
That's
was that interesting?
Yeah.
Did you guys find that interesting?
I did. I don't know if our listeners will.
Yeah, I know, but
Yeah, that is all interesting.
Right. I guess I need that. I know, right out of the gate, I punched Chris in the gut again. So now I got to get ready for the embarrassment thing. You know, bringing up, you know who. But are you all right?
I'm all right.
Okay, all right. Good.
CJ Raisin's all right.
But that was I did weasel that in there pretty well, huh? Yes. You were totally not.
I didn't see it
that.
Coming.
Yeah.
That was good.
All right, I think we're good. Okay. We're ready to transition maybe into more serious here, and hopefully it'll lend well to our conversation later with Dan Dupuy. Kent, you want to go ahead and ask the question?
Yeah, so our question is, who is or how did they impact you, but the person outside of your parents who had the greatest spiritual impact of your life?
Yeah, on our lives, yeah.
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 Yeah, it's great.
Jason? You have somebody?
Yeah.
I ask this question to youth workers all the time because I want them to see what, as they start to think through who these people are, then we talk about character traits and you start to see what's important in our relationships with kids. Who do you have?
Yeah, you know, the very first person that comes to mind was our associate pastor, youth pastor, when I was a junior in high school. So it was after my baseball incident, but I was a junior in high school, and you know I wasn't the easiest of students when I was in high school. But Kurt McFarlane, Kurt pursued me, wanted a relationship with me. He just modeled everything that I would hope for in a youth worker, where he met me where I was and walked with me and loved on me. I mean. He was a little bit younger than I am now. He was probably in his early 30s, but he would come over to my house just to hang out. He showed up at games, soccer games, like you're talking about. It's boring to most people, but he would come and he would watch the entire game. And I think what I really loved most is that he was always pursuing me, always wanting to have conversation, always wanting to find out what was going on in my life. One of the most profound moments in my life to this day, it still sticks out, was it was a Friday. I went golfing with him, and I don't know where we were at, but in Arizona it gets really hot pretty early, and we were sitting underneath a tree waiting for the group in front of us to finish their hole. And I just remember asking, this is me as a teenager, hey Kurt, why do you spend time with me? And I will never forget his answer. I was 17 or 18, and he said, you know what? That's a great question. He goes, I spend time with you because I consider you a friend. I consider you someone that I want to spend time with. I want to get to know. And just like any friendship, you make investments.
Yeah.
And you make sacrifices. And that's when he said, I don't know if you know this, but Fridays are my day off. But I made it work so that a way I could come and we could spend this time because it was the only day that worked for you.
Are you still in touch with Kurt?
Oh, close friends. Yeah. He's still an associate pastor at a church. Actually, what happened is one of the reasons I'm at in Spokane is because of him. So he a few years later transitioned out of the church that I was that I'd grown up in, came up to the Northwest, worked at a summer camp. I followed him, came up to the summer camp, worked two summers at that summer camp. So he moved from being my mentor, youth pastor, to becoming my boss, to then him. It was because of him that I went to Whitworth University, checked out Whitworth, fell in love with it, and then ultimately stayed in Spokane because of that. And he transitioned out of the camp and now is in a church about 2 hours away from here. And so we spend a lot of time, and actually the incredible thing is my wife and I have gotten to invest in their kids, much like he invested in me and my brother. We've gotten a chance to invest in his son and daughter. Yeah, it's been an amazing journey.
Yeah, the thing that just is so powerful about that, and I hear this all the time when I ask this question, is this matter of likeness, you know, that something rubs off when someone's serving Christ and spending time with us, youth workers here. And it could be just another adult in the church, perhaps, but, you know, in my case, it would be the same as you. This desire to be like, you know, to want to emulate, to imitate. Yeah. And I think there's, you know, Paul talks about that in the New Testament. For me, it's the same thing. I would choose three guys who were instrumental in my life during my high school years. My freshman year was my first youth pastor experience. A guy named Phil Douglas, who I sometimes mention his name when I go places and people light up because they know him. He is on the staff as a faculty member at Covenant Theological Seminary now in St. Louis. But Phil was a seminary student from Tennessee and would come on weekends as a student pastor and was our youth worker. Then the next year, because they would only come basically for a year or two, the next year was a guy, same seminary, Mike Barbera, came over from New Jersey. You know, they were all students at Princeton Theological Seminary. He came over and spent the weekends with us, was our youth pastor. And I just saw on Facebook that Mike preached his last sermon. He stepped down from the church he was at. He's retiring. And then, it's hard to believe we're at that age. And then the last one was for 2 years, my junior and senior years, a guy named Chuck Wiggins and his wife Kathy were ministering to us. And I think it's all the same stuff you mentioned. You know, they wanted to spend time with me. They cared. They were good friends. They talked openly about Jesus. They would entertain questions. They would push back when there needed to be pushed back, but they were always loving and grace-filled, and they would stick with us no matter what. And I know I can speak for so many of the people in our youth group that these guys made a real difference. And by the way, when Phil came, this is really interesting. I can talk about this. Phil, you know, my dad is a pastor. My dad was a supervising pastor, and I know that when Phil left after, you know, the school year with us, he wondered if anything he had done, anything he had said had stuck or made a difference in anybody's life. And speaking for myself, absolutely, absolutely. And I know I speak for others as well, that even when it seemed like to him what he was saying, the things he was teaching us were being overshadowed by what we were learning from our peer group or from the culture at the time, you know, back in the early to mid 70s, 1970s, it made a huge difference. And there are quite a few of us who are in ministry. I know I'm one of them who the influence of those three guys made it clear. God used them to make clear to me what my calling would be in ministry. And so I'm grateful to them and thankful to God for them and indebted to them for so much. So, yeah, this is good. Well, we're going to talk about influence when we come back from our break. And we're going to talk about the influence that parents have on their kids that, unbeknownst to many, continues right through into the college years. We're going to be talking to Dan Dupuy about his brand-new book from Baker Books called It's Not Too Late, The Essential Part You Can Play in Shaping Your Teen's Faith. We'll be right back. Stick with us. In an effort to help you help the kids you know and love navigate the difficult landscape of the emerging digital frontier to the glory of God, we've launched a digital kids initiative here at CPYU. Thanks to a generous grant from a company called DAS, you can access our digital kids initiative and a growing number of free resources and downloads by visiting the website at digitalkidsinitiative.com. This is one more way that we're helping you lead your kids to live lives where their faith in God is integrated into the growing amount of time they're spending with social media and technology. Well, welcome back, everybody, to this episode of Youth Culture Matters, and I am really excited about the guest we have today. It's our friend Dan Dupuy. And Jason, let me just tell you a little bit about Dan. I've known Dan for a long, long time because Dan actually is on the board, the chair of the board, and the former president of the Coalition for Christian Outreach. And I'm going to let Dan talk a little bit more about that in a minute so people know what the CCO is. I used to work for the CCO. But the reason we've got Dan on today is after all of his years with the CCO, he has written a book that is an interesting book for someone who ran a campus ministry to write, because it's actually a parenting book, a book targeting parents. But when you read it, and even when you see the title, it's a great book for someone like him to write. It's called It's Not Too Late, The Essential Part You Play in Shaping Your Teen's Faith. It's published by Baker Books, and it's a fairly new book. I had a chance to look at the manuscript before it came out and learn a little bit about what Dan is writing about here, and I think it's a great book for parents. I think it's a great book for youth workers, and I think it's a great book for youth workers who are listening, to get into the hands of parents. Jason, you're a parent of little ones, not even in school yet, so it's going to be great to have your perspective on this as you ask Dan questions. I'm the parent of kids who are all out of school and into their young adult years, so it'll be fun to interview Dan. Jason, have you read any books like this before?
Or? Just a few.
I know you've read parenting books, but...
Yes. But regards to books like this, well, definitely, especially with the ministry, we're always trying to find resources. So I'm really excited to speak to Dan and hear some of his thoughts around parenting, especially around a very difficult subject.
Yeah. So, Dan, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, Walt, thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
Well, good. You know what? First thing out of the gate, just talk a little bit about the CCO, the Coalition for Christian Outreach, because I know some folks are familiar with the CCO, but since it's a regional ministry there in Western Pennsylvania and the surrounding geography, it would be good for people to hear what it's about, what the CCO is about, because I think it is a very unique campus ministry in terms of its approach and theological bent. Tell us a little bit about that and your role with the CCO over the years and what you're doing now.
Yeah, the CCO grew out of a particular vision for Pittsburgh, to make Pittsburgh as famous for God as it was for steel. And in 1971, a group of parents, youth workers, pastors pulled together a coalition of people who could go to area college campuses. And the reason there was some urgency around this was, first of all, the opportunity to reach students who were far away from God. But secondly, we had kids from this region who were going to college and walking away from their faith, which is something that still happens, obviously. So that was when the CCO was called into existence in Pittsburgh. We are now on about 120 campuses, all within about a day's drive of the Pittsburgh area. The approach that we have is to do our work collaboratively with churches, with colleges, with community organizations. And we are committed to the local church as a means of discipleship for college students. And we believe the idea that Jesus is Lord of all of life, as it's articulated in Colossians 1, should call students to faithfulness in whatever area they pursue vocationally. That's the CCO in a nutshell.
Hmm. And the vision that you mentioned, you know, to make Pittsburgh a city as known for God as it was at the time for steel, that came from John Guest, right?
Well, actually, it came through John Guest, who was our first executive director, all the way back to Sam Shoemaker, an Episcopal clergyman who came here in 1955. He was the one that articulated that vision initially.
And what was happening was, I remember talking to John Guest, he would come over from England to sing and do crusades, evangelistic meetings with kids, high school kids, and they would come to faith, he would leave, he'd come back, they would go off to college, and it would seem, and this is not a new issue. I mean, we talk about it a lot in the world of youth ministry. You know, Christian Smith writes about this, kids leaving their faith, but he was seeing that they were leaving their faith, and so he saw a need for a bridge, some kind of bridge ministry for students when they went off to school.
Yeah, that and it's interesting to read some of the early writing that John Guest and other people did about the CCO back in the 70s. And the issues that they were concerned about are the same ones we're dealing with now.
Yeah.
The ones that Christian Smith and other people have written so much about.
Yeah. Now, those guys were they heavily involved in high school ministry? There was a tie with Young Life, right? And I'm thinking about that because Jason's got some Young Life ties out there on the West Coast. It was a lot with Young Life, correct?
Oh, yeah. Young Life was thriving in Pittsburgh in the 1960s, and that accentuated the problem, of course, because you have all these kids coming to faith in high school, and then you just didn't know what was going to happen when they got to college, so we had very tight ties with Young Life.
Well, so really, you were So were you, real quick, were you acting as a bridge then from high school then into college in many ways? Was that some of the thought behind that?
Yeah, the initial thought was to do as much together between high school ministries and college ministry, recognizing, I think, that it would take both of us to really build a bridge. That was the original thinking behind a lot of what we did, including our first student conference, which we now call Jubilee. The original idea behind Jubilee was to get as many high school students in the room as college students.
And that's great.
Yeah, and you know, the unique focus of the CCO is, you know, and as I've traveled and tried to explain it to people and seen other campus ministries and how they function, the unique focus is really the depth and level of training with the integration of faith in all of life. And that really struck me. I mean, Dan, I don't know if you know this, but when I was a college student at Geneva, you know, I was discipled by Lowell Meek, who was my RD, and I don't know if you remember Lowell or not, one of the early CCO staffers, who really helped me understand what it means to see Jesus as the Lord of all of life and how that can be integrated into every nook and cranny of life, including as a sociology major, you know, the social sciences, and I know the same thing for the hard sciences. So students can go to Jubilee if they're a math major and learn what it means to honor, glorify, and worship Christ through the discipline and the exercise of their skills in mathematics. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. So, yeah. So thanks for your work with that. Jason, actually out on the West Coast, just so you know, this has lived on the college campus for how you just moved off, Jason. So how long was it you guys were on the campus?
We did 5 years. 5 years in a college dorm, 170 students. Wow. So a small liberal arts Christian college out here on the west side at Whitworth University. It was my alma mater, but my wife had never attended, all of her siblings had. And so we got to live and engage in life, which was absolutely one of the most incredible things that we got to do early in our marriage.
Well, that kind of position dips you pretty deeply into the lives of college students. That's a great thing, Jason.
Oh, it's a beautiful thing.
So Dan, let me ask you about this, all right? Because it's just an unusual thing. I remember when you were talking about writing this book and you were saying it was going to be a book for parents, I scratched my head a little bit. I get it, you know, reading it, and I think it's an important thing for someone like you with your experience to write for parents. But what compelled you to write this book for parents of teenagers as someone who had spent all those years ministering to college students?
Well, the reason that we were called into being the CCO in the first place is still very much a part of what we do. So depending on whose data you look at, Walt, anywhere from 60 to 70% of students who grow up in the church leave it during the college years. And witnessing this over and over and over again and sitting across the table from parents for years who've seen things, the train really leave the tracks during college, and also seeing my own staff do great work but not always be successful in folding young people into fellowships on campus. You know, I felt for years that this is something that could be different than it is, and began to dig into it and dig into the data, in particular Christian Smith's, you know, 10-year study, the three waves they did during the National Study on Youth and Religion. And that led me to sort of the doorstep of parents, because that was one of a handful of things that turned out to be most critical in the years running up to college, was parents continuing to be engaged in the lives of their sons and their daughters, and then in the lives of other young people as well. And so, you know, in spite of myself, I think I ended up writing a parenting book. It's not what I set out to do, but it's certainly where the data led me.
So in your work creating a book much like this, was there anything that stood out to you in the research that you conducted as you were preparing to write the book?
Yeah, there were a number of things that stood out to me. I think that obviously the first one I've already mentioned was that parents really do continue to have a central role in the nurture of the faith of their sons and daughters when those sons and daughters are teenagers, which isn't how we often think of it. That stood out. The surprise piece to me, and this is from Christian Smith's work, was the influence of adults who aren't parents. You know, the man in, I put it this way, the guy who sits in church behind you every Sunday with the comb over, that guy, you know, that maybe, you know, I sometimes now as I age, I realize that I am that guy.
But you know what, that descriptor right there connected with everyone who's listening, because everyone envisioned probably 10 guys in their church who sit behind them with comb overs, right?
Absolutely. And you know, the funny thing is when you dig into the data, you start to realize that that guy with a comb over could turn out to be a pretty big deal in the life of your son or daughter. And I did not see that coming. There's not very many things. There's only about 6 things that Smith identified as really critical for 18-year-olds, patterns they saw for kids who had a good transition through college. And one of them is, again, these, you know, the comb-over guy, other adults who care about your kids who will invest in them. And that really surprised me. That popped.
So does that mean, when you say invest, does that mean that the parents working hand-in-hand with the comb-over guy, or is that just something that, because you're attending the same church or in the same community, that they're hopefully sharing the same values? I guess the question would be, is there anything a parent can actually do to utilize the force or strength of that one character in their son or daughter's life?
Yeah, Jason, I think there is something, and I took Smith's data and started working it into my focus groups, I found that this idea of adult influence, it could be something that's, you know, happens very happenstance on a Sunday morning. It could be very intentional and very deep. What parents can do, and what we ought to be doing anyway, is to model what it means to be part of Christian community. So when we're plugged in with other people, we're walking the walk with other folks in a small group with our neighbors, you know, living in a connected way, this happens pretty organically. Now, I use the example in my family's life of 3 other couples that we've been friends with since we were in our 20s. We're spread somewhat across the country now, but we still see each other 2 or 3 times a year. You know, the youngest of those kids who are now teenagers just found out about a year ago that they're not actually related to my kids. They thought they were. They thought they were their cousins. Because we built friendships with their parents, and the connection then between, you know, my kids and my friend has happened quite organically. That's the best answer to the question. Being in community yourself connects your kids to other caring adults.
So you do emphasize, and this is one thing I like about this, just the role of mentoring. That and what people need to hear from this is that, you know, once your kids are grown, your work is not done. I mean, number one, that's irresponsible to think about that with your own kids, but the power of influence that you have to shape younger lives, to shape young lives, whether it's a college student or a newly married couple that's sitting across the aisle in church, is powerful, and people need to accept responsibility for that and seize that responsibility for many reasons, but one of them just being purely pragmatic. I mean, what a great influence you can have. So you've, in your focus groups, you picked up on that.
I did. Once I started asking the question about the influence of other adults, people started telling me their own stories. It was like a flood of people remembering how someone had an impact on them. And it could be as simple as the guy who remembered their name and every time they were home from college, remembered where they went to school, what they were majoring in, and asked them how they were doing. It could be as simple as that, all the way to a profound, deep mentoring relationship. You know, the interesting thing about this, Walt, you bring up our responsibility. this has actually changed how I engage with teenagers, because I realize they're really, you know, every moment that I have in the sphere of a young person could be a big moment. You just can't tell. So I've kind of woken up to the opportunity that I have to engage in conversation with, you know, teenagers that I would think they weren't interested in talking to me. And lo and behold, when I show an interest in them, they've reciprocated. It's been a game changer for me, really changed what I do.
Yeah. And one of the things you talk about in the book is defining the goal for young adult children. Why did you decide that this was something to write about?
Well, it felt like an awfully unspiritual thing to do. You know, what does success look like, you know, for a 23, 24, 25-year-old? But I was challenged by a friend of mine, if I'm going to write this book, to have enough guts to say, begin to articulate what a picture would look like if the project worked. That is the project of seeing our kids nurtured into their own faith in Christ. So I took this question of what would a good transition look like, and I put it online. I got about 310 responses, and that's how I worked up the definition. In the process of doing it, one of the reasons I had a deepening conviction this was a good idea to get clear on the goal. I actually think we all have goals for our kids that are unarticulated. We think, you know, if things work out, we hope that they will end up being this kind of person, living this kind of life in this kind of place in conjunction with these kind of people. And I think what I've seen and what I've heard in conversations over the years with many Christian parents is the goals get confused when they're not articulated. So by not being explicit about what it is that we want to see happen with our kids, you know, granted that only God can do it, but by not being explicit about it, we graft in a lot of other definitions of success from the world around us. The one I've seen the most often, no surprise, would be material success, that becomes the ultimate. And of course, there's nothing wrong with wishing that your kids would live independently of you financially, but it's a bad ultimate goal. You know, Jesus is really clear talking about the love of money versus the love of God. And I've seen many young people fall prey to that, primarily through the influence of their parents, who seem to be modeling something where the goal's a little bit muddled. Is the ultimate thing Jesus, or is it something else? That's how I came to the place of having a definition.
That's a curious thing. I'm really thinking about that as you say that. And I just want to ask you this before we take a break. That whole materialism goal, the goal of materialism, you know, there's a reason why there's more said in the New Testament about the dangers of money and wealth than, you know, what Jesus said in the Gospels, more about the dangers of money and wealth than about heaven and hell combined. Have you seen over the course of your years in working with college students that that's become more and more of an issue for the professing Christian student to work through that?
Yeah, I think it has. I think it's always been there. I think parents have always wanted their kids to be better off than they were. But I think it's because I don't hear much, see much, that in the church where we explicitly address, you know, issues of you know, the love of money, greed, those things that are talked about, as you mentioned, talked about quite a bit in the New Testament. It's not talked about all that much in church, and so I'm not sure people know how to navigate you know, the temptations that surround it. So yes, I think we got a lot of young people on campus for whom there's some confusion, and you know, in the absence of anything else, making a whole bunch of money sounds like a pretty good idea.
Yeah. Well, you know what, Dan, as a former CCO staffer, I can say to you, the former president of the CCO, now chairman of the board, boy, those early years right out of college, you guys did everything you could to turn us away from materialism with that salary we earned, that money we had to raise. That was the bad thing about that is, as I'm saying, I'm going, well, that could really backfire, you know, because that could really spark some materialism where you're wishing for more. But those were I say that in jest. But, well, listen,
yeah.
Hey, this is good. We're talking to Dan Dupuy, and he's the author of a new book published by Baker Books called It's Not Too Late, The Essential Part You Play in Shaping Your Teen's Faith. We're going to take a little break, come back and talk to Dan a little more about his book and valuable conversation for parents and for youth workers. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Are you interested in bringing CPYU to your church, school, or community? A big part of our ministry is the on-site seminars we conduct in dozens of settings every year. CPYU seminars are designed to encourage and educate your audience on a variety of youth culture issues. Every seminar is designed to be informative, practical, and hope-filled. If you want to learn more about our CPYU seminars, available speakers, and the many seminar topics and options in our growing seminar lineup, go to our CPYU homepage at cpyu.org. Click on the seminar option on the menu bar at the top of the page, and you can learn more about how to schedule a CPYU speaker and seminar for your parents, youth workers, and educators.
Welcome back to this episode of Youth Culture Matters. We're here with Dan Dupuy, and we're talking about parents and their influence on their kids, and specifically a new book that he wrote, and we're having a great conversation. Before we continue, though, we have something that we like to do here on this podcast, which is, Dan, we like to ask our guests five questions that have really nothing to do with what we're talking about, but allow for our listeners.
Or anything, for that matter.
Or anything at all, yeah. But allow our listeners to get to know you a little bit different than what they might just from hearing about your book. So are you up for this?
Oh, yeah.
This really, let me just clarify, because Jason was trying to come up with a purpose for these, and I just realized it really is a chance for our guests to embarrass themselves.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, so
yeah, we do it often on this podcast, so we allow for you to do the same. So it's quite fun. Well, hey, here's the first one. Hopefully they're not too hard or take too much brain energy, but here's the first one. So what is one vacation spot you love to visit most?
Oh, that's easy. There's a place on Lake Huron in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. It's actually owned by our sister organization, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. It's called Cedar Campus. And every member of our family would choose that one place to be above any other place on the planet.
That's awesome. Is there any one memory from going there that you have that sticks out? This doesn't count as the five. I just am curious.
Yeah, oh, it's an additional one. There, we've been there 22 years. I think the one memory that comes to mind right away is bringing a babysitter with us and having her try to swim a mile in the frigid waters of Lake Huron, almost killing our babysitter, which would have been kind of a tough, you know, kind of a tough thing.
Was that by choice, or was that a deal?
No, it was her choice. It was her and you know, these crazy teenagers.
She put the kids to bed 10 minutes late, and that was punishment.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
We had swimming out to that island and back. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. Okay, so give us an idea of who your childhood hero was. One childhood hero that you had.
Yeah, I think a childhood hero I had. I grew up in Cincinnati, and I was fortunate enough.
Can I guess?
Oh, you can guess.
Was it Pete Rose?
Well, you know, he actually was. He wasn't the guy.
Okay.
Johnny Bench too. Dave Concepcion was my favorite. Was my favorite Cincinnati Red, but nobody remembers him. So Pete, yeah, shortstop, good memory, good, not bad for a Phillies guy, you know. And Concepcion, terrific ball player, Venezuelan guy, a lot of fun. He would have been for every kid in Cincinnati. Pete Rose, believe it or not, hard to believe now, was a role model because he played at 110% every minute. You know, he ran to first base on walks. He had a small amount of talent that he grew into a big amount of results. So, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so give me an idea of your food of choice if you've been stranded. Maybe you're stranded on the island that your babysitter was swimming to, and you've been there for 6 months, and now you're coming back to civilization. What is going to be the first food that you go for?
Boy, yeah, you know, it just feels cliche to say this, but a big old hamburger. You know, we're not talking McDonald's here. We're talking quality stuff.
Burger King?
easy. We don't want to go too far up the scale.
All right, okay.
One of these high-end burger joints might serve.
Okay.
Yeah, White Castle.
White Castle. Yeah. You know, if you did that you're on a desert island, you might hurt yourself. I wouldn't do that.
All right, so hamburger. Okay. So then let me ask this. Whether or not you have a bucket list, it doesn't matter. But one thing that might surprise our listeners, if you were to have a bucket list that would be on that list, that would completely surprise us. That would just be like, what? That's really on your bucket list? That's a thing that you most want to do?
That's so I got to come up with something that people wouldn't think of. Little difficult to do. I'll say this. A lot of people don't know that I play the piano, play the keyboard. And I would love to be a lounge singer. Yes, I would. It's true. I really would. I'd love to be a lounge singer. Belt it out every night. Hey, I'll be here, folks. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So Billy Joel was singing about you, the piano man.
Yeah. You know, yeah. That's the picture I have in mind.
I
have a picture in my mind, and it's rapidly filling up with people from our CCO past. I see some of them sitting on the piano with their leg.
Long as they're putting money in my pocket.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, last one. What is one song you can be anywhere and doing anything, but it consistently comes back up in your mind, or maybe it's not always coming up in your mind, but just something that like sneaks up and you're like, why is that in my head? It could be a song from the childhood, maybe a marketing song, maybe an advertisement. Is there any one song that every so often you find yourself singing it or humming it or having it play in your head?
Well, you know, the one Home on the Range comes to me, but I grew up, it does, it really does, but that's, I don't know why. It's a cowboy thing. But I grew up on Earth, Wind, and Fire. And I'd say that Shine and Star, you know, that's a good
one. Shine and Star.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right.
That one works.
Yeah, well.
Well, thank you for playing with us. That's excellent.
Hopefully, if it gets stuck in your head, it's not going to be Jason singing it. That was...
Well, it was an approximation of the tune. He was close.
Yeah, that was, I would say that those were good questions, Jason, and that had to be the biggest hodgepodge of answers we've ever heard. Nothing wove together there. It was just, for a guy who headed up an organization, it was all about integration. That was horribly disintegrated, Dan. But it was good. I enjoyed it. That was really good. I couldn't have guessed any of those.
Well, now you have a sense of what it would be like to work with me.
You're the enigma. You are the enigma.
I can surprise people sometimes.
Oh man! Hey, well, let's go back. Thanks for doing that, Jason. Let's go back to talking about your book. It's Not Too Late: The Essential Part You Play in Shaping Your Teen's Faith, a book written for parents. Dan, towards the beginning of the book, you talk about seven myths. That might be sabotaging your parenting. Pull one of those out that folks would maybe benefit from. They're all beneficial, I get that, but choose one and talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think the first one is the one that is the most pernicious of them. It has the most impact on everything else, and that is the idea that parents of teenagers are peripheral. That somehow during adolescence we move farther and farther and farther and farther from a place of influence and are replaced by peers, and in a ministry context are replaced by youth workers. leaving youth workers with the unenviable task of trying to do things that only parents can do. So that myth that I think is embedded deeply into American culture, that parents of teenagers are just irrelevant. That's the biggie. Everything else tends to sort of spill out of that one.
Dan, when you talk about that, I'm thinking about back in the 1980s, reading some work that was being done by David Elkind, who was writing not from a faith perspective, but from the perspective of being someone who was watching the emergence of a new kind of childhood in America. And he wrote books like All Grown Up and No Place to Go and The Hurried Child. And one of the things that he said that we do to our kids that does a tremendous disservice is we create adultified children. And part of the dynamic of that, he said, was, you know, they hit the age of 12 or 13, they reach puberty, they look like adults, and suddenly now we treat them like adults and we let them go. We figure we've done everything we can and there's nothing else we can do. And he was actually saying back then, you know, this is going to kill our kids. It is pushing them beyond the brink. And I think a lot of what we see and what you've seen and what your staff has seen with the CCO on the college campus in terms of anxiety, stress, depression, even what's behind a lot of the crazy party life that for so many kids is just redemptive, although they wouldn't say it that way. It's a reaching for redemption is rooted in that. So I think what you said there about that myth is really important.
Yeah, and when this theme gets picked up, I've alluded to the National Study on Youth and Religion, and there we talk later about a couple books that came out of that study. But you know, the what Christian Smith notes is that parents will tend to move most quickly out of talking with their kids about God. That's the one. You know, of all the things, because you got to keep talking about finances and grades and boyfriends and girlfriends and, you know, all those sports and all that stuff. And with Smith, the picture he paints, there's a very poignant passage in his book, Souls in Transition, where he talks about kids looking for what he calls a conversation partner. And at the exact moment when they may need us the most to fill that role, we have made ourselves unavailable to them. I'd read you the quote, but every time I read the quote, I start to cry, because the picture is so devastating. To think of a kid who desperately needs somebody to talk to, and the most trusted person they have in their lives has made themselves unavailable because they don't believe they have a place in that child's life at this particular time. Pretty hard.
So is that part of the solution then, when it comes to a parent that believes that they no longer have that influence to both be engaging in conversation with their son or daughter, but also to maybe even have conversations with other parents? I mean, in your book, what are some of the things that you actually talk to when it comes to the parent that believes that they don't have influence?
Yeah, I think the way we put it in one part of the book is to move from control to conversation. Smith talks about having a relationship, but having it on some renegotiated grounds, acknowledging that our kids aren't 10 years old anymore. You know, it's not command and control, although that never worked in my house anyway. But, you know, that our kids they're turning more and more and more and more into the adults who will be able to function outside of our home. And so, yes, it is. It's staying engaged in conversation, staying relationally connected to them, which may mean we interact with them differently. It should mean that when they're 15 and when they're, you know, when they're 8. That's what I want parents to do. And in the book, I actually coach them through what those conversations can sound like.
So when you talk about because one of the things you mentioned just now was the idea of position of control versus a place of influence. Yeah. Could you maybe give a distinction between the two?
Sure. I think the control is what you have with a very young child. You know, don't touch the stove. The stove is hot. You know, this is not an opportunity for negotiation. right? you have to learn. You do not do that. You do not run out into the street. You do that. You know, those are appropriate places for parental control. As our kids age, we sense that we're losing that control. I think that's the dynamic you described earlier, well, that was documented in that work in the 1980s. You know, the sense that, hey, I am losing control. This relationship is changing. And what often happens at that point is parents back completely away. You have lost control. What you have is influence. And influence works differently than control. It's acknowledging, you know, this is another person. I can't make decisions for her. She's going to decide ultimately what to do. And she's, in a few short years, going to be on her own. But I can exercise healthy influence through conversation, through experience, through continuing to make myself available to spend time with this young person.
And that, you know, as you say that, one thing that comes to mind is something we've been telling parents for years. And I need to tell myself this. I think we all do that. The control issue is one where it leads us to believe that we can drag our kids screaming and kicking into God's kingdom. Mm-hmm. That's the work of the Holy Spirit. You know, we have to be faithful and obedient and let God do God's work. Yeah. Which brings up another issue that you talk about or you write about in the book, and that is prodigals. Talk a little bit about that and why you included that.
Well, I think in the course of working with college students and being with parents for years and years and years, you know, many, many families have at least one kid in the family who's taken a completely different path. We know students on campus who have made decisions that, where you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. They've decided to engage in things sexually or with substances or, you know, all kinds of different possibilities. And those are, they've oftentimes done harm to themselves and to other people. So all the things you can imagine that go into what it means to be a prodigal, those are things that families experience all the time. Most of us have some sort of prodigal story attached to our families. That came up in my research, and it became really important then to have something to say to families that have had that experience, because most of us have been there.
And that would include suffering, because you write about suffering, correct?
Yeah.
And the suffering that comes to us by circumstance, or the suffering that comes by choice. I love what you write here. You say, God allows hard things into the lives of his well-loved children so we can become the people he wants us to be. And everything I've read on suffering over the last few years, I've focused a lot of reading on that. That's a great summation there of something that we as parents and we as a culture seek to avoid. We pursue pleasure and try with everything that's in us to avoid pain, but suffering is actually a gift, and theologically to enter into the sufferings of Christ is a good thing. So that's great that you include this in here. Talk a little bit about that, why you wrote on suffering.
Yeah, it wasn't part of my plan. I don't, you know, suffering I have found to be a challenging part of the Christian life. You know, to rejoice when I face trials of many kinds, as James says. I'm continuing to learn how to do that. I'm not very good at it. I've noticed that watching our kids go through hard things is much harder than going through them ourselves. But I was leading a focus group in Northeast Ohio, and I'd asked parents if they would get a little feedback from their kids and bring that into the focus group. And the question was, when have you felt most alive in your faith, closest to Jesus Christ? And the evening was almost over, and one of the parents said, you know, my son told me something I almost forgot, but I think you need to hear this. So I said, fine, you know, what did he say? He said, well, he felt closest to Jesus when he was 15 years old and he lost his best friend to leukemia. And I, you know, nothing had really prepared me for that. And that sort of broke things open on the whole topic of suffering and beginning to earnestly grapple with what happens when God brings hard things into the lives of our kids. how are we to respond to that? Because I think it's a difficult thing for all of us who love our kids. Mm.
And I think, you know, just what you said there, I've had some conversations with some friends who have lost people close to them recently, and it's been interesting to see the people who respond the way that young man did. You know, I lost my friend to leukemia, that's when I was closest to God, and the people who respond the exact opposite. And I've been trying to figure out, you know, that's a mystery, but I've been trying to figure out if there's some sort of dynamic there, like what has or has not happened in that young person's life or in that person's life to prepare them to respond to suffering in the way that they have. And the closest thing I've come to in terms of an answer is to say that to develop a good theology of suffering and an understanding of suffering before you actually suffer or have to go through those difficult times is really what the key is. You know, the foundation that you build or you choose not to build is what you'll spring off of. So, again, and as I say that, I'm thinking to myself, this is a great value of an organization like the Coalition for Christian Outreach, because we talk about those difficult things. We engage with students at the level of good theology and no pat answers, but, you know, filling their wells with this. So, yeah, this is good, Dan. This is great. Let me ask you one more question, and we're gonna finish up here, turn the corner and finish up, and that is to get very practical. You've worked with college students for years. You've run an organization where you've got lots of people, you know, boots on the ground, to use that metaphor, who are engaged with college students in their lives 24/7 through the staff at the CCO. After all those years of doing that, what are some practical pointers you could give to people, or practical steps? I'm thinking particularly of first parents and then youth workers, to stay in touch with the students who have left home, who have left the church, who have left the youth group. What are some practical ways, some of the best practices we can engage in to continue to relate to and nurture the kids that God's entrusted to our care who are now off at college in this next phase of life?
Yeah, I think the for parents and youth workers could figure into this very very naturally, but for parents, you know, I think there's a talk that a parent should have with a child before that child leaves home. There's only two things in the book I sort of script, and this is one of them. Because I and what it sounds like, I'll tell you what it sounded like with my boys, was, you know, Jack, Spencer, they're twins, so we do everything in pairs. You know, Jack, Spence, you're getting ready to head off to school, and I'm really excited about the adventure you're going to have and everything you're going to learn. And as you're getting ready to do this, I realize, too, that the choices you make, they're going to be your choices. I'm not going to be with you. But there are two requests that I have of you, and there's only two. And one of them is that you connect to some sort of Christian fellowship on campus. It can be a Bible study on your floor. Could be a fellowship, you know, a big fellowship somewhere that meets in one of the academic buildings. That doesn't make any difference to me. Just being with other believers on a regular basis and digging into Scripture. That's one request I have. The other request is that you get connected to a church, you know, a place that you worship with other people, that you're there regularly. That's it. Those are my requests. And you're going to be the ones deciding whether or not you're going to do those things. Your decision, not mine. Your choice, not mine. But when I see you, I will ask you about both of them. So that's what the conversation sounds like, that I think there is no silver bullet for this stuff, by the way. But that conversation, you know, raises the level of intentionality that we have with our kids. I think it would be a great conversation for a youth worker to have on the launch. Thing I think youth workers, just to encourage youth workers, you who do that work at that moment in that transition, you're the one with the credibility, you're the one with the trust, you're the one with the relationship. So what you say about what comes next matters, I think, a lot more than you may think it does. So, you know, making recommendations, introducing students two particular campus ministers that are on a campus, particularly if the student's going to school nearby. I think the launch is kind of a big deal. The transition is a big deal. And I'd say get as intentional as we can get about it and use the credibility that you have as a parent, that you have as a youth worker, to point the young person in a particular direction, acknowledging that it's their decision. They're the ones that are going to choose what they're going
to
do.
Yeah. So to just consistently connect, what I hear you saying is you prepare them to launch, and then you're following up all the time with, hey, how you doing? I'm checking in. How are you doing? Yeah, that's good. Good advice. Dan, this is really good. I love the conversation we've had. Again, it's Dan Dupuy. He's written this great book, It's Not Too Late, The Essential Part You Play in Shaping Your Teen's Faith. We're going to include a link to this on the page for the podcast, and you can click through, as always, for any of the books we mention here, to our friend Byron Borger at Hearts and Minds Bookstore. Byron's an independent bookseller. He'll give you a deal on this, and the details on that will be on the page. We're going to mention some other books here in a minute that we've asked Dan about. But I'm just going to end with this and then turn it over to Jason. One quote in this book that I think is great, and you've got it italicized in the front end of the book and a couple of times, and that is the goal. You know, what is success? And I love this. I'm going to read this, and this is what we need to drive for as parents. This is what we need to pray for, drive for as youth workers. You write this, Dan. It says, the young adult Christian owns his or her faith in Jesus Christ, reflects it in priorities and decisions, and lives it in community with other believers seeking to influence the watching world. That is a great definition of what our goal should be for our kids. And so I appreciate so much, as a dad, this book, It's Not Too Late, and the help that it's given. You know, again, my kids are older, and I just have to consistently realize it's not too late. I need to continue to be a dad and to have these kinds of discussions even with my adult children.
Yeah, and I think that this is just a wonderful tool for me, too. I'm on the other spectrum, and I'm just really glad, Dan, that you took the time and did the research to put together a book much like this. It's a great tool that sounds like you put a lot of effort into, and that it's going to bless many. And you did mention some other books along the way. Are there any that you would like to add to this list? One that I wrote down here was Christian Smith's Souls in Transition, which is a phenomenal look at what's going on. But you also had maybe a couple of others. Is there one or two others that you would have us add to our list and link on our podcast page?
Yeah, I think the Kenda Dean's book, Almost Christian, that comes out of the same body of research.
So good.
That book to me is as powerful as anything out there, and is challenging, and it really follows the research very faithfully. That's a terrific book. Some of these books are a little bit academic, but there's a book written by a guy named Vern Bengston, Bengston. I think it's called Families and Faith. It was published just as my book was going to the publisher. And Bengston did a 38-year study, 350 families. And he taught at the University of Southern California. 38-year study on how faith is passed from one generation to the next. And his family has about 400 years of history, which is about as many as you can have, of being evangelicals. And he has a very interesting personal story related to all this. He came back to faith at the age of 67. But the book, Families of Faith and the Research, Families and Faith and the Research Around It, is really good.
That's great.
Yeah.
Wow. So Families and Faith and Almost Christian, we'll make sure we add those. And again, thank you so much. And also, I'm sure that we'll have a link, or if we don't, I know that we often here at CPYU talk about the CCO. So thank you so much for the way you have contributed in just so many aspects. And thank you for being here today to just share some of your wisdom with us. So with that, I just want to say thank you for listening to this episode of Youth Culture Matters. We look forward to being with you again in the future.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.